This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 27 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Thanks for listening. Today we have a special guest, Richard Terrell, who I've had on before. He is one of my favorite game designers, and I think one of the strongest voices out there for progress in game design, and his work that he's doing at designoriented.net. He's got this big system where people will be able to search for anything anyone has ever said about games or game design on the internet, and possibly not just on the internet. It seems very exhaustive and very cool and a great project. And so anyway, he's a really cool guy, and we had a great conversation that I'm very excited about sharing with you. A couple of quick little house cleaning sort of notes or updates before we get into that conversation. I have sort of a new game out. Not really. It's something I built in like 2 or 3 days, and it's called You Have a Gun. And it's almost like, in terms of interactivity and production values, it's only like one step above like one of those like, you know, click on the thing banner ads from the 90s. Click the monkey, like throw a banana at the monkey sort of things or whatever the hell they are. And so don't expect much gameplay wise. It's more of like a installation art statement kind of thing, and it's about first person shooter games and how they are really just clicking on things come on the screen and then you click on them until they go away, and the only thing that like actually is keeping the way that I phrase it is, this is what I see now when I try to play a first person shooter. I don't know how successful it's been in communicating that, but it's something to check out if you like. It's probably takes 2 seconds, and so that's one thing I've been doing. I also have I have been working on Battle Blast. If you guys don't follow me already on Twitch, I've been streaming quite a bit, actually, doing some visual art, some League of Legends, sometimes some Oro, but mostly visual art recently for Battle Blast. And so you can follow me on Twitch/KeithBurgun. I recommend doing that. And also, I've started on the next Dino Farm game, and that's been going really well. And we expect that one to be a pretty quick production. We're shooting for like 6-ish months. And now I know that originally with Oro back in 2011, we said that it would be 3 months, and it ended up being 6 years. So hopefully we will. I don't think it'll be anything like that this time. We're working in Unity. I know how to program now, so I think it'll be pretty quick. And so we're excited about that. We haven't announced what that is yet. We've talked about some. If you look through the Dino Farm forums, you can see some posts about some game ideas that we've been bandying about. I will say that this project is none of the things that we talked about before. We've been working on it now for 2 or 3 weeks. Things are going pretty well, and I will have updates on that at some point on this podcast, but I also definitely want to talk to you guys about the Battle Blast game. So I already posted about it on Dino Farm. You can get a little bit of information there. I will have Patreon updates, especially for the first people who will be able to test the game. If you're interested in trying out a new game from me, is you can become a Patreon patron at $5, the $5 level or whatever, and then or greater, and then you can be one of the first people to test this out. And it's already, we have a very playable build. This one's really kind of moving along. We hope to have that one done, I don't know, 1 or 2 months from now. It should be a pretty quick production. We'll see how things go, but it really shouldn't be too long, because it was a project I had kind of working in the background, and it morphed into something new. And anyway, it's coming along well. So that's just the quick updates. I guess I usually put those at the end. This time I put it at the beginning, but that's because I know that you want to hear this great interview with Richard Terrell, designer of Barabari Ball. If you don't know what that is, go watch a video of it, gameplay video or whatever. It's just, if you can't get your hands on it, I mean, obviously if you can get your hands on it, do so. It's on PS4. It may be on other platforms, but look it up. It's great. Watch some videos about it. It's really cool. You can also go to designoriented.net to see what Richard's been doing. He used to write articles. He says he's going to be coming back to write more articles in this interview, which is pretty cool and exciting. But yeah, he's a smart guy. The interview went really well, and I look forward to you telling me what you thought of this interview. So without any more stuff, here comes the interview. Why don't you start off by telling me what you are working on these days and what you're doing, what you've been up to?
Yeah, still just working a lot in developing tools for games criticism, looking at a lot of different sources, still building up the database for Design Oriented, upgrading our backend so things are smoother and faster. But in terms of design, we've been working on a lot of scripts that can analyze the entire discourse, like every single word from every single entry that we have inside the database, and run data analysis on those, right? Mm-hmm. So if you just have a word, right, like hookshot, and you want to know every single quote mentioned by anybody who says the word hookshot, you'd be able to find all those quotes instantly without, you know, just by typing in a word and hitting enter, right?
Right.
So then when you really start putting these tools to work, you can really get a sense of what everybody's saying. And instead of just being a general approximate of like, these are the writers that I read, these are the critics that I respect or pay attention to, this is what I think everyone's saying, you can literally have data that actually takes into account what everyone is saying.
Seems really, really useful.
For people like us, perhaps. Yeah. People who actually care about what people are saying or how much they're saying it one way versus another. Right. Yeah.
Which is funny because it actually blends in exactly to the conversation I want to have with you today. But I in general, I think those tools are really awesome. I think that the stuff that you've shown me so far from it just looks really impressive, and I'm very excited about that kind of work. Do you know if there's other people doing similar kinds of projects?
I've heard of one person that wanted to do something similar along the lines of building a database for critics, but you know, that was just an idea that one person had. I don't know if anyone else is doing actual linguistic analysis, and if they do, they're usually limited to the domain of just academics or whatever.
Right.
With DO, we go and we look at podcasts and YouTube videos and forum posts and tweets, even if we can, and try to capture everything.
You also try to get academic papers and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah, so? Yeah. There are a few really good academic sites that have a ton of stuff, so just grab this. Everything that's free and open to the public, we grab.
How many people are working on this project?
Just five or so. Just my brother is primarily the script engineer. I'm working on like the visuals and the overall design. We have one web programmer and then a couple of other people that, you know, supervise, bounce ideas off of, and can do a little bit of web backend.
So it's your brother who's doing most of the like almost AI-ish kind of scripting?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. And his background is in programming? Like that's his main thing?
He's math degree, and he has taken a few courses in programming. I think he had to take an online course or two on Python in particular to do a lot of the stuff he's doing now. Mm-hmm. So whatever he feels like he needs, he just does extra stuff for extra learning.
I also wanted to, I don't think I've ever asked you, like, what's your background in terms of, like, you know, game development skills and that kind of stuff? I know you as a game designer, of course, and I think you are also really into fighting games. I know that. But other than that, like, skills-wise and disciplines-wise, like, where do you come from?
My degree is in English, so
interesting.
It's not really any technical field or programming related, but everything that I know about programming was just self-taught, running through tutorials with Game Maker, reading things, just trying to keep up. And anything my brother learns, he just discusses it with me, so I can read code. When we worked on Bar Volleyball, it was primarily in Game Maker, and we had the original guy, the chief engineer, doing all the coding, but I would get in there, write it in the scripts, and just either manipulate the data or comment on how it was actually programmed. So I can read it and I'm familiar, but I'm not confident enough to write the code from scratch myself.
Right. And the fact that you're doing, I guess, graphic design for this new project, does that, you also have a background in visual arts?
Yeah, just one of my favorite hobbies throughout the years. Music,
Gotcha.
art, music, art, games.
Right.
Those are pretty strong.
Yeah, so that's cool. I mean, we both come from very multidisciplinary backgrounds. I think it's interesting that you studied English in college. What made you, like, if I might ask, what made you want to follow that exactly?
Yeah, initially it was like, I have a lot of different hobbies and interests, so I'll pick one that would seem to be easily transferable to like different locations and places. I could write for various types of people or travel anywhere and write from there. So that would give me a lot of flexibility that I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time I was double majoring in mechanical engineering and English. So then I dropped the mechanical engineering, just did English, was going for a minor in Japanese, but just made it out with the English. That was enough.
Oh, that's cool. Do you speak Japanese like decently well at this point?
Not fluently. I can read it decent, just decent. But
that's cool.
Yeah, I tried playing Ni no Kuni on the DS all in Japanese, and it was slow going.
I should hit you up for some Japanese learning tips. I've been spending about maybe 5 minutes a day for the last 2 years trying to learn Japanese. So after the podcast, I'll hit you up for some advice.
Oh, cool.
On that.
Yeah.
I also, before we want to get into the main thrust of this episode, I also did want to comment on Barabari Ball and talk about that a little bit, because I don't know if we've talked about this last time or ever before, really, but I really appreciated that game a lot. And one of, I think, the best contributions that game has to game design and to fighting games specifically is the idea of the ball. And specifically, the reason I think the ball is so great is that it separates sort of like one player's input from another player's output somewhat. So like, I don't know if you've read my stuff about like input randomness and like, you know, how you want that information horizon. The ball, so in my opinion, like Street Fighter and Smash Brothers and every fighting game is at its absolute worst when the two characters are standing right up next to each other and like trying to like hit each other. I think that is like almost like a total breakdown of like what the game is supposed to be. Whereas the ball makes that situation totally like, you would never do that. Like, there's no reason to go right up next to each other so much. You know what I mean? Like, and so I just wanted to share that thought with you on the ball and why it's so important and why I think other fighting games should, like, my next step, and I would like to hear your thoughts on this, would be to have a fighting game where you can't actually even hit each other. It's just all about manipulating a ball or maybe a series of balls or some kind of network of some kind of object that you're sort of moving, you're influencing and stuff like that. So anyway, just some thoughts on Barabari Ball, which I appreciate a lot. And why don't you respond to what I just said?
Yeah, that's about one of my favorite things to discuss with Barabari Ball as well. It's that even still within the genre, and even borrowing a lot of design elements from Smash Brothers and Street Fighter, the biggest, most obvious, and most impactful design element that's different is the ball. And it gives you a lot of the same kinds of interactions that you would find in a fighting game, but it reads differently. It's a very different type of feedback that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So while in fighting games, frame advantage, block stun, even move hitboxes and things can be really hard to discern and very dependent on these really hard to discern, fast moving dynamic factors, like which hitbox you hit, how high above the ground you hit, like all these little minute things. And Barabari Ball.
Yeah, I gotcha.
In Barabari Ball, it's just easier to see a big ball go back and forth and who has it caught. And if it's glowing, then it can't be caught, but it's deadly to the other player. It hits them in the face. And taking the same kinds of interactions, but changing the way people read it, both experienced fighting game players and non-gamers, right? People can just see, oh, that ball's drifting off the edge. That person better get it. And if that person barely misses it, like, oh, so close. And
yeah.
easily people of all different types can see what are close plays, what are not close plays. When one player has the clear advantage, it's really separated by space. Like, how far away is it running? There's one character running from this one, and will he catch up in time and things like that?
Yeah, yeah. Another way to frame it maybe is just that you're using the space of the screen better. Like, you know, like if you think about like in Street Fighter or something, there's like one pixel or maybe even less than a pixel worth of difference that makes a huge, that means like you got to be looking at this like tiny little part of the screen to understand the difference in a tiny amount of space. Whereas with the ball traveling around in large arcs on the screen, it's like you're actually just using the screen better. Isn't that another way to put it?
Yeah, I that kind of design consideration I call a fidelity. And depending on what kind of game interactions you're looking for, it's way better to use more of the screen. It's way better to have visuals that are easily read from far away or up close, or if the camera pulls back or whatever. And depending on what kind of game you're going for, you might want to make very specific design decisions that say, hey, if they can't see pixels when the camera zooms out, let's not make our game so dependent on if you're pixels away from hitting this move or not hitting this move. Let's make it less about that and more about this.
Right. So, and yeah. And even further than the pixels, even I would say worse than that, is where you have so a character on screen is, he's like in some position or whatever, but he has a giant spreadsheet of two coordinates worth of tons of like hit points and armor and magic resistance and cooldown reduction and, you know, all this like tons of RPG stuff that's all contained inside this character. And so to me, that's another example of like using the screen really poorly. Like, so what I tried to do with Oro was I took like the roguelike concept and I said like, well, let's get rid of all that like behind the scenes like spreadsheet stuff and try to put all the complexity on the board so that you can visually look at the game and see like, okay, this, so instead of a character having like this much hit points and this much armor and this much attack or whatever, it's more like that's all represented on the grid and like, oh, there's a threat over here, but I have this going for me over here. And so
yeah,
it comes down to just using the screen well, I think, in a way.
Yeah, I really like that idea. Certainly, you know, all games have numbers and things running behind the scenes, but the numbers and stats that you want the player to be most aware of when playing can either be a sheet of paper in the back of their mind or something that's on the screen. And there's pros and cons to doing it both ways, but I like having things visually represented and spatially represented if at all possible.
Right. Okay, so that's cool. That's a really good transition into the main point of this, I think, conversation, which is we've been talking a little bit about, you came onto my Twitch stream the other day and we talked a little bit about broad versus narrow statements. And what we were just talking about was actually a pretty broad statement, I would say. And because we're both sort of saying, I think you're trying to pull back from saying it too strongly, but I think we both kind of agree that in general, it's probably better if you can, make better use of the screen and show more things on screen and not have things be these tiny little esoteric details or in some, database somewhere. Right. So do we agree about like, isn't that a broad statement? Because just so I clarify for other people listening, I think you said that you are kind of against making broad statements. Is that right?
Well, I said in general conversation, if people go too broad too quick, it's not a lot of useful takeaways that you can get from that. But if in general conversation people stick to their, personal, direct hand, firsthand experiences, the conversation has a lot better chances of people understanding each other's sides and walking away with even broader statements that are more accurate.
Okay, so let's talk about what do you mean when you say people's personal experiences? Like, what would be an example of somebody speaking otherwise? Like, I agree that people should speak based on their personal experiences and like, have a good understanding of who they are and where they're coming from and stuff. But like, how would it manifest if someone were to do otherwise?
Yeah. It can be something instead of opening a conversation and saying like, oh, I think, all fighting games are terrible. You're like, okay, well, nobody's played all the fighting games. So tell me about a few or one in particular that you think is particularly bad, or can express your thoughts well by talking about example, and then you can look at very specific things that the game does instead of just talking in general, like, well, which game or which mode did you play, or have you played this game? No, oh, I love this game. It sounds different than what I think you're mad about. And instead of worrying about all the undefined aspects of that statement, just getting closer to the actual experience or match or thing or game that
I see
started the conversation in the first place.
You're actually pushing for specificity. I'm not gonna be able to say this word now. I don't know what happened. Specificity. There we go.
Yeah.
That's it. So right, like that's what you're asking for, basically. Mm-hmm. It's better for people to be specific, and I agree with that. But I think, would you also agree that there is a place for sort of coarse, rough, like, you know, in general kind of statements? Like, because, yeah, there, you haven't played every, like, let's say someone was like, yeah, I think fighting games are bad or something. So it's true. They have not played all fighting games. You don't know what they mean by that. There's a lot to be clarified. But I think there's also, it's a conversation starter, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if somebody says that, like, okay, well, why do you think that? Give me some examples, then you can clarify. Mm-hmm. So I agree it's good to, like, drill down after making broad statements, but I also think there's value in those kinds of broad statements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I took some notes here just to try to organize some of my thoughts. And I think what you're saying, obviously true, like, I think there's no real difference between a narrow statement and a broad statement. It's just a matter of context. It's a matter of how zoomed in you are and how useful you find the application for that statement at various levels, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not that we're saying, like, oh, zoom all the way to the bottom to you're like an inch away from it, or like, you know, fly up into the clouds and that's the only place to zoom. But there's obviously a spectrum going on right there.
Yeah.
And for any statement, I wrote down three things that I think are the core factors to consider. And one is how complex the original subject or experience or example is in the first place.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're talking about something really simple like fun, well, then you can make a general and broad statement like everybody loves to have fun. And by definition, that's pretty much what you'd expect. Like, fun is the thing
That one is almost fun, like tautologically.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then the second thing to consider from a statement is the range it has, how broad it is. So, you know, kind of like what we were saying in this conversation, which fighting games? Is it a Street Fighter-esque fighting games? Is it more of the 3D fighters like Tekken? Are you talking about platform fighters like Smash Bros? Like, more, there's a certain range that people either have in mind or would like to address, and figuring out exactly where that is an important thing to make clear. Mm-hmm. But the third one is, whoever is listening to the statement, depending on their level of experience or structural knowledge or whatever, or how robust their language is and how willing they are to work with your statement, it determines how much they'll get out of it. So you could have someone that makes a really broad statement that doesn't know too much about it, but you have someone who's an expert in that field hear that statement and go, oh, I think this person means this and this and this and this and this, and because of this, I want to slot it in here. And these group of people often share this view, so they could put your statement on the map, so to speak.
Right.
And they could really contextualize to a reasonable degree what's being said. But if somebody doesn't have that same level of experience or dedication or time, then the effectiveness of that broader statement would be checked by how experienced that person is, I think.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. I think you absolutely have to consider who it is you're speaking to, and, you know, how your message is going to be taken. I think there's a lot of sort of politics that have to be taken into account when you talk about broad statements, especially because, you know, I've certainly stepped in this a million times of, like, you know, just saying some broad statements about, I don't know, Euro games or something, or mm-hmm. whatever it is. And people getting upset. I mean, people definitely kind of are personally attached to things, and, you know, you don't want to actually upset people. Like, that's definitely not the goal. And if you're doing that, that, you're not communicating. So it's, you know, you kind of can't avoid the sort of political angle of it. You're speaking to human beings. They have feelings and you want to communicate with them. So you got to play by certain rules, or, you know, there's guidelines that can help to get that across. And so, yeah, I think we basically agree on these points. I would just, I guess my thing is, So my, you know, my whole thing is like, I'm trying to find like guidelines for general better game design. And like, for example, I think we just talked about one, like try to put things on the screen where possible. Now that doesn't mean that there aren't exceptions. There aren't some things that you absolutely do want to be like hidden in some database or in some pixel perfect little tiny micro universe. But it does mean, in general, like, it's a good guideline to go by. And so you don't oppose those kinds of statements, right? As long as they're clarified and kind of, or what's your feeling on that kind of a thing?
Yeah, those are good. Both thinking about creating guidelines like that, expressing them, even, you know, debating them, I think is good and healthy. It gets people thinking about design, you know, for design's sake or as design. And even though they may all have their own particular view, the particular examples that come to their minds as they wrestle with your concept is, I think, really healthy for design discussions in general. Because everyone, you can imagine everybody is an exception because their own personal experiences are all different and they all see things differently. So that's kind of like a great way to just check the power of your guideline in the first place. Like, how many people are going to object immediately to what I say? Right. And then where does the conversation go?
Yeah. No, I agree. And I'm glad that we agree on this, actually, because I guess I misinterpreted you a little bit. I sort of thought that you were more resistant to broad statements. And would you agree with me that there is a contingent in the game design world that is actually pretty resistant to broad statements? Like in my opinion, it seems like that's actually the one of the sort of fundamental truths of game design, is that there's sort of like, you can't make any broad statements. right? Does that sound right to you?
That's the kind of thing that I wish we had our databasing tools for. Because I think what you're reacting to, I've heard people react like that, like, oh, you can't say that for sure. You can't tell me how to make my game. You don't know. What about this specific case?
Right.
And essentially, that's kind of what we were saying. There are exceptions. There can be a lot of leeway, but how much of it only applies to a genre? How much of it only applies to indies versus AAA? Like, who knows if there's even correlations that can be drawn along those lines? So to answer that kind of question, I would love to back it up with a bunch of data, because maybe what you're responding to is very true for the people circling around your Twitter most often. Because I have that same experience, but not all the time. So I know what you're talking about, but it's not enough to say most people in my mind.
You said what I am very eager to see the finished version. I guess there will probably never be a finished version, but like, you know, an advanced developed version of your software actually shows on this issue. My feeling is that game designers typically tend to, like people who really fancy themselves game designers, I think they tend to actually more come a little bit out of the humanities a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And so they tend to have a more of this kind of resistance to like, you know, solid sounding answers. Whereas interestingly, I think actually gamers, people who play games, are very openly, they're totally comfortable with that. I feel like they're very, like, you know, I mean, the classic example is them just saying like, oh, whatever, this thing sucks. You know, like, that's a very dismissive form of it, but like, they're very comfortable with, in general, making big broad statements. Go on.
You said that before about gamers. It was really interesting. I feel that because gamers are on the ground floor and they are the ones, you know, head first and heart first, absorbing these various disciplines, because each game is like a world unto itself, and all the time and practice and study they put into it gives them a sort of a unique perspective and experience on it. So whenever they make these states, yeah, some of it, most of it, 99% of it, it's hyperbole. This character's broken. Nerf this. What are you thinking, developers?
Yeah.
They are expressing themselves very strongly, but very clearly about one aspect or another. And like you said, they have no qualms about throwing their fiery arrows at developers or anybody else just to try to express themselves.
And actually, game designers may be responding to that somewhat, because like we actually are the brunt of it a lot of the times when you know, our players are like, oh, you idiot, you're like, you totally should have done XYZ. And so we get resistant to the idea of anyone saying anything at all, which like we can go too far with it, maybe.
Yeah, it happens. It's so hard. Like, that kind of ties into some of the things you were mentioning before, but the whole, do we have the language to talk about a game like Aro? And that ties into what you were just saying about how players talk about games in general, and then what to make of all these statements, right? Like, different temperaments, different attitudes, different levels of experience, all trying to communicate with each other. And yeah, that's why I really like studying games and game design right now. It's kind of like the Wild Wild West, but it's really like everyone's on different islands, I feel like. And whether or not some people are more serious about establishing a language, using a language, or even that there needs to be a language, and then all the resistance that can come from other people, other perspectives, other islands, if you will. That's just kind of how I see things playing out currently.
Yeah, totally. And it makes sense. I think that is how it would work, is that we would have, because we don't have much of an institution of game design, really. It's not like, you know, we don't have any like central, we barely have like any, you know, thought leader type people. We barely, like, it's all very scattershot, and like everything is, I agree with the Wild West analogy, and I also agree with the islands analogy. I think there's something to both of those. But, you know, I think that, I think personally, we're maybe on the cusp of a real, like, some real progress in the discourse of game design. And I think that the work you're doing is part of why that's going to happen. But I also think we're almost reaching, I can sort of sense that we're almost reaching like a more mature era in this kind of world, in this discourse.
More mature generation growing up.
Yeah.
Just got to put your hopes in the kids and hope they grow up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think so. Yeah. And
you have your clockwork design system, your whole sort of network and language and way of thinking about games. And, you know, I don't know about your personal experiences of you using it with people who are more or less familiar with it and how that goes. But I know personally, I get a lot of pushback when I talk about language and game design, right? To various people. And sometimes the words they say are so contradictory. I have to clarify, because it doesn't make any sense. Like, you use the word here and then you use it here. It's the opposite. Now I don't know what you think. Like, and if I'm sitting here putting in work to try to figure out what you think, it would be good if you helped me out and, you know, asked or clarified some of these language issues. But, with the design-oriented project overall, we have our own language and our own system, and we know there's resistance for people accepting it or using it, but we have tools that build a dynamic glossary out of every single word that everybody uses, both for specific game terminology, like bumping and RO, right?
Yeah.
And that's a specific RO word. Its function is similar to other things in other games, but if somebody says bumping, most of the time, hopefully, they're talking about Aro. And then broad things like frame advantage, which is something that becomes most necessary to use as a term and a concept in fighting games or competitive games where the melee combat and when they hit each other, whether it's on block or hit, you need to know how much extra time you have to throw out another attack, XYZ. Like,
right.
So whether it's via genre or game specific, we're just assembling an entire huge growing list and then, you know, organizing that list by, you know, design topics or genre, and then we can start cross comparing everything. So if anyone out there thought we were just trying to push our own agenda, our agenda is a little bit of everybody's agenda, and
right.
hopefully we can find some middle ground.
Yeah, and I mean, I think also your software will do a really good job of just demonstrating the way that language like works. Like,
yeah.
like people tend to think like, okay, like a word works the way that I use it, or a word works the way that the dictionary says it is. But the reality is that every word has like all these crazy tendrils, just like, you know, connotations, like a whole like radiant sort of circle of like, you know, like every word almost means every other word to some percentage, you know, like like the word game probably means the word like, I don't know, tree, if to like 0.0001%, you know what I mean? Like every word is kind of connected in some way. And that may be an exaggeration, but hopefully you just understand my point. And so like people use words in very, very different ways. And, I think that your site will actually kind of help demonstrate that to people, that words are way more flexible and way more, they just have way more baggage to them than everyone realizes. You know what I mean? Like, and yeah, I think that's a really positive development if that can happen.
Have you heard of that indie game called Synonymy, I think it's called?
No, I haven't.
It's essentially a huge dictionary, like organized network of dictionary terms, and it gives you one word and it says just merely by I think the words in each word's definition get from one word to another in as few steps as possible.
Oh, neat.
So when you said like game means tree, that's the kind of thing that the game would they tell you to do, like go from game to tree. And you're like, okay, games are, and then you'd have to find some common concept or word in the multiple definitions possible for game.
Right. You're like,
get,
there's a,
get the tree.
A decision tree, like, right?
Yeah. Or like, you know? Game theory. Okay. Yeah. And then like, tree descending, you like, you'll work your way through conceptually, which is really cool.
No, I agree, and it's, I think, important for people to remember that like concepts all have these like tendrils going from each other, and you know, and I think that like there are people who are very like I don't know, there's two sort of forces fighting against that. I would say that there's people who are like, no, I have my things the way I like them, and you're threatening them. And by you know, putting out these some alien definition for something that that threatens me in some way. And then I think on the other hand, there are, you can also kind of overstate the baggage of a word, maybe. Like my feeling about the word game is a lot of people are very defensive about the word game because they rightly understand that people do have a, like when you call something not a game, I think that is actually, they are right to say that in a way you are kind of like delegitimizing something a little bit. Like I think that's a little bit true in some sense. But I also think that that just needs to be weighed against the, like, you know, anytime any definition is going to be like have pluses and minuses. And I agree that that's a minus. But there's, you know, you got to kind of like figure out what tool has the best pluses in the and the least minuses, you know, for a given job. Right. And so that's, we just got to think of language as more like tools to achieve objectives. My system of like forms and the clockwork game design stuff is very like objective oriented, and you know, so I'm trying to do very specific things. And so yeah, I think we just need to think of language more that way, and hopefully I think your work is actually going to help with that.
Hopefully. Otherwise I quit.
Yeah, have you started to get any feedback from it? Like, I don't even know if it's, is it public yet?
Not the scripts, the website, designoriented.net, it's public, it works, it's on the slow server right now, so we'll do a bigger push when we can get things as speedy as modern internet allows.
Gotcha.
But until then, we're just running scripts and seeing how useful the data can be, seeing if we can build bridges with it instead of just telling people stats they don't care about, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
What, a couple other questions I had about it. Did you, have you gotten much feedback either from the design community or from, I don't know, academics or anything yet?
I did a lot of reaching out to people before we launched last March, and they all thought it was a really neat idea. They all want to see it succeed in something like it, where they can, you know, go to one place, type in something, and see a whole history of conversation around that topic, and then also, you know, understand more about what's going on. From academics, from designers, because a lot of these topics, like you're saying, are shed on design ideas, and people, whether they're well researched or not, make claims, and finding a way to sift through that and organize it is something that will help them in their daily design work. So a lot of just general positive support for it. But as far as being useful to the general gamer, you know, hopefully, because all the voices are going in one place, they won't have to consider themselves, I only watch YouTube videos, or I only watch, only go to forums, because if they type in the word here, they get everything, and they don't necessarily have to make that call before they see what's out there.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And so when you have like faster servers, and when this is in the form that you picture it ultimately being in, is it going to be like costly for you to run this? And do you have any ideas for like funding such a project?
Hopefully not too costly. Funding, we're going to try to roll along with a, just the site will be up as a tool. And then we realized early on, like earlier this year, that even though the site's up, we can use it because, you know, we're the designers. We understand all the language. We understand everything about how the tool works and what's out there, because we're putting all the stuff in there. But the general people, they don't understand
how to
game
use
design
it?
As, really? They don't understand. I think the core issue is language, and that's why this is a really cool podcast to be a part of, because they don't have the words to understand all the various parts in the game. They want to say things about a game, but they stumble over either not having the words or not having the concepts, because, you know, those two go hand in hand. Then they stumble upon like how they interact with other people who are trying to express themselves, and it's the current mess and tangled ball that we're currently in right now. So when we try to reach out to people and show them stuff and talk, it's always comes back to these issues of, I don't think they can really understand what we're saying or what we're offering. And even when we say we value everything you guys have to say, like the whole discourse, but we want to make it better for you, easier for you to find each other's voices, and then listen to each other's voices. That key step of listening doesn't happen until we do something more to get everyone on the same page in terms of language and thinking about games.
Right.
So I think we're going to launch a video series and just kind of basically go over my blog, the design course series I did on my blog, and do everything in video series so that people can watch it at their leisure. There'll be short enough lessons, kind of like your 3-minute game design, short enough videos where they should be able to consume it pretty easily. And that'll be a first step into building the support and the understanding needed to hopefully make the whole thing work.
So let me just clarify that. So you are going to make videos that sort of like help people to understand how to use the tool?
Or how just understand game design. And then the tool will just be a part to show them where else they can take their interest once they understand whatever.
So
we'll start at the ground level.
Okay, so I have to tell you that one of the things that makes me sad about the tool that you've been working on is that you, like, I want to see more like articles from you and more videos, more content, more game designs. And because, you know, I consider you one of the world's best game designers and, you know, best thinkers on this stuff. And so I mean, Is that something that you kind of are going to be doing like more of?
For a while I put down writing about games for, I guess, 2-3 years now, but I'm really feeling the itch. I got to say stuff, and I still have all my old notes of articles I just never written. So now I'm thinking high quality, make videos so they're shareable, you know, catch everyone else up, but then really start to build quality content while leveraging the tool. So one thing I wanted to do was say, hey, here's the concept. Here's what everybody thinks of it. I mean, here's what gamers think. Here's what the devs think. Here are the topics I think we're not hitting, but you can see everyone's opinions in there somewhere. Now let's see what we have to say about that. Now let's take it to the next level. Now let's think about what we could do better. But after showing everyone that, hey, everyone had a chance to say what they wanted to say. Okay, here's the breakdown of what that looks like. Okay, here's where we're going to go next.
Right.
I don't want to ignore people, but there's steps to it, right? It's a long process.
Sure, yeah. Cool. Well, did you have other things that you wanted to chat about in mind?
We touched a whole bunch of it. I think, let's see. Just even things like RO and the language that players either had or didn't have to talk about, and what made the design elements of RO made it more difficult for people to talk about. We touched on it.
Oh, yeah. That's right. You said you listened to my last podcast episode.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And why don't you talk about that a little bit and like your response to what I had to say on that?
Cool. I really liked the episode. Serious time, somber tone. That's a little unfortunate as far as the success of RO, but I do appreciate the honesty greatly, and reflecting on all these things it's rare, I think, and really, really helpful to both understand where you're coming from and just, you know, what's happening around RO in general. One of the things you said about the game is that people weren't talking about it, and you mentioned a few things like granular, small, fine choices makes it harder to articulate like what you did. There's nothing like item builds or character matchups to talk about.
Right.
And there's a gulf between how much you like and appreciate RO and its design versus how you think other people understand it, appreciate it, or like it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And this is sort of, there's a lot of things to discuss, like, is it possible for the game to have, you know, injected a few language terms or nuggets here and there to help people talk about it? Is it just a inherent issue of this kind of design or what? Those are all interesting. But I think the one thing we can talk about is how this is sort of the issue that I think everyone who tries to, you know, communicate or make art faces. Like, you have your zoomed in, like, intimate, close level view of the thing either you're trying to make or the thing that already exists, and then you put it out into the world, then you're just trying to see how they take to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned in the podcast, sometimes people just don't have enough time to dig into your thing. Sometimes it's so new, they don't have existing frameworks to understand it. And sometimes it's just, they don't like things the same way you do. So there's a bunch of different reasons why it could be, but I can definitely relate to this idea of working really hard on something and polishing it and getting it just the way you like it, and then not knowing exactly why it's like changing in the transfer process. Why, when it goes from you to them, what's happening in that in between?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I guess the simple answer is, like, you know, obviously different people are different. They have different experiences, and, you know, but I mean, we all know that. And I think that part of being no matter what, there are some people who know, like, various, they have some degree of like formula for presenting things to people that people are going to like. You know what I mean? And so there's something to like learn there. And so, yeah. I didn't actually follow the response to Barabari Ball, but how was the response to that in general? Was that like what you were hoping to get response wise, or did you have any similar kind of experiences with that at all?
Yeah, I think when it was at Evo and we were showing it off, the people who sat down to play it really liked it. So that's always why we make the games. People play it and like it. It was part of a 4-game pack, right? Sports Friends. So
yeah,
looking at the reviews, when your game is 4-1, you only get so much specific mention, but
right,
it seems like the critics got the bulk of the game, which is, you know, just like you're saying, the ball is the point. Play around the ball. We can definitely understand that it's Smash Bros. With a ball, and from there, you know, they had fun. That's
right.
Great. So I'm really happy with how it turned out. As far as the kind of depth and to tuning and balance we put in for tournament level players, really the only thing we saw on that level was when we literally took our stuff to tournaments and people competed in free tournaments that we would hold. So we know the game has the potential to support those kind of players, but we knew from the start it wasn't going to get a community. It wasn't going to have the kind of legs and the support it needed to be a thing, like to have events. Yeah. So this is about all we could expect. And I think we're pretty happy with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's interesting is that, like, that game, like, I could picture a lot of people, like, just maybe even just, like, a programmer who doesn't really fancy themselves as a game designer so much, but just putting together, like, oh, I'm going to make some cute little fighting game thing, and you have a ball, you know, like, and but they don't really put much thought into it, and it's just kind of like this little dumb little, like, I don't know, dodgeball variant kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel like I could imagine a lot of people seeing Barabari Ball and thinking that that's what it is and not realizing that, like, no, this actually was, like, really well thought out by someone who, like, totally knows their stuff. And that's a frustrating thing, I think, for game designers who are designing for other serious players and other game designers and other people who really take games seriously and think of them as more than just, like, a little toy to go beep boop bop boop around for 5 seconds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's a frustrating thing. And then at the same time, though, there's so many people out there. In fact, probably the vast majority of people kind of do sort of just want something to just, like, click on and just, like, you know, not really thoughtfully dive into. So there's a real maybe disconnect there too, in terms of, you know, with game as for me as a game designer, I want to make the kind of game that I would want to play. Well, what's the kind of game I would want to play? It's something that's, like, extremely, you know, deep and elegant and maybe has a bit of a learning curve but pays off for the learning curve, you know, and so that's what I make. But, like, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to know how many other people are there out there like that. And so that's an interesting thing.
That's what I was going to mention with Aro. I mean, it just really seems like it's Bergen, digital Bergen, right? Like, this is the game you wanted to make. This is how all the design sensibilities you were trying to work out. And you it's all represented in Aro, or at least as much as possible, given the history. So you do all this work and you probably spend a lot of time tweaking things and refining things and changing enemy patterns. And I remember reading your articles on when you changed, what is it, how the points carry over from, like, level to level, and then you reworked the score system multiple times and, like, different things like that. Just really thinking about, like, what is this thing and how do I make it either to my standards or make it worthy of this, like, putting a lot of time into and really digging to it.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff, by the way, is I would just describe it as just fixing problems. Like, there are literally actual problems. When you really sit down and play the game, there was the XYZ problem. Let's fix it. We can fix it, so let's do that. And we did that. You know what I mean? Like, it's less philosophical and more practical. But go on.
Well, one of my hopes, I mean, you put a lot of work into it, and then it's just this, like, standalone thing. And for better or for worse, the audience takes it to it one way or another. But for me, in the projects that I work on, I mean, I've done games criticism projects and made games now, and sometimes it feels like nobody notices or cares about all the hard work you put into something they were only mildly interested in the first place.
Right.
But I think moving forward, I hope that it rolls forward into more and more things. Like, now you're more confident about where you want to take your next project and the clockwork design principle. With me, I know Barabari Ball has, like, Atari graphics, right? I would love to design. I mean, I dreamed of all these different kinds of graphical styles that would just sell the game better, just make it more interesting to look at. 3D, 2D, doesn't matter. Like, obviously, it could have better graphics, and that's a huge issue for a lot of gamers. Mm-hmm. Obviously, online play is a huge issue. Stuff like that. I was designing single player, like a whole sort of Metroid, Super Metroid-esque type single player for it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I roll a lot of that hard work in what we did with Barabari Ball forward, and now I know at least I can prove to someone else, either by explaining it or letting them play it, the level of specificity that we looked at it, the level of polish, the pros and cons of every design decision, it's all in my head. So that's got to mean something.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, every failure is like a learning opportunity, and whatever is the next thing that you know, if somebody makes something and it doesn't go the way that they wanted, well, the work that they put in that first thing is all going to really carry over into the next project.
Yeah.
Like everything that you learned is going to be expressed in this next thing that you do. So, you know, I think I don't feel like it was a waste. I don't regret anything about it. And, you know, I'm proud of it. And so, you know, it's definitely, I think it's good to have kind of a positive look at failure and sort of, I think that actually like being good and being like smart is not so much just like about getting it right. It's more about learning the right lessons from getting it wrong. And so that's what I've been trying really hard to do, because, you know, there's a lot of temptation, a lot of like, you know, there are some people who are like fans of the game, and they'll kind of, it's funny, they actually serve sometimes as the voice in my head that wants to make me kind of like make an excuse, you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, you just didn't have a good enough marketing budget or something like that. And it's like, no, I have to learn something. Like, I have to actually take responsibility and really like actually learn something from this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I just think it's an interesting thing how like, you know, as creators, it's very easy to just like kind of come up with a explanation and tell yourself a story about why it wasn't your fault, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just super, you know, counterproductive to do that, I think.
Yeah, that's a healthy attitude. Just even if it's not like really your fault, just see what you can see, assuming it is, and then thinking as cleanly as possible about all the things you could have done different.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so that's cool. I'm glad you appreciated the episode and stuff. And you know, I it's funny, I felt a lot better after making that podcast episode and kind of just like putting it all behind me, starting a new chapter, that kind of thing. And it's you know, that's another cool thing about like failure and stuff, is like you can always get up the next day and just do the next thing, and you kind of always have another chance for something else, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. Do you have any other thoughts on that whole topic?
No, that's everything I had.
All right, cool. Well, we're coming on about an hour, so I guess we'll probably wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
But I am very excited for... now, what is the name of the... do you have a specific name for the tool? I know it's at designoriented.net, but is there a name for this actual tool?
Yeah, we haven't named it yet, so I don't even know if that's the kind of thing we can build into the site. I mean, like somebody can figure it out, but we'll come up with a name by next time.
Okay. It needs a name for sure. Like, it's right now we're just calling it like this weird tool.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I'm looking forward to that a lot. I'm also looking forward to new content from you in terms of game design stuff. Like, we need more people like you and I think, doing that kind of stuff. So I'm looking forward to what you do in the future. And obviously, you said you don't have any new games in the works, or?
No, I mean, when we were first starting DL, we were trying to both write content for the blog, for the site, and make little game demos to demonstrate that content.
Uh-huh.
We stopped halfway on a project that was really supposed to demonstrate game feel by letting you like take up every single property or whatever that we discussed in the article, and allow you to play a game and see how much it affects you as you go along. So we really would love to do stuff like that, make content, organize things, and make games to kind of all work together. So yeah, maybe you'll see something like that.
Okay, that's a really interesting it seems like a high cost sort of way to operate, but also high reward. Like seems like extremely instructive for people to see the difference between, you know, like what it feels like to do a good jump or like a bad jump in a game.
Yeah, or like how much does screen shake really matter to you? Like, okay, right, let's go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic idea. In fact, it might be better to just mod existing games if that's possible to do to save some time. But anyway, that sounds awesome, and I'm looking forward to that.
Cool.
So thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll probably do it again at some point, as long as you're down. But yeah, thanks again for, you know, for your thoughts on the podcast and for everything you do.
All right, no problem. It was fun.
All right.
So that concludes this interview and this episode. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll let me know what you think in the comments, and share this podcast. It would really be helpful. Also, if you can write me an iTunes review, that would be really cool. Or any review, really, on any site where you can review podcasts would be really nice. Please let me know what you thought. Thanks for listening. And to my Patreon supporters, thank you so much for being a supporter. And I'll see you again next time.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.